Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Hello, welcome back to Fright School. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
Oh, I'm so tired of this.
Of this period.
Yes, gestures broadly.
My Jimmykins recommended that we should play that My Chemical Romance song, I'm Not Okay, as our new theme song.
Yes. I don't know what the rights would be. I don't know. That might be expensive.
They also might not care.
I'm sure their lawyers would. Maybe they wouldn't care, but their lawyers would.
Yeah, lawyers would, yeah.
Which is who's usually behind that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's just, it's very, I'm definitely starting to really feel, I mean, we're how long in? 6 months?
Just about
6 months into this, and I'm really now really starting to feel like the effects of it. Like, I really miss people. Obviously the holidays are coming, the most important one ever, Halloween, and you know, it's kind of like, oh, we're not gonna have a big party, you know, and the holidays are gonna be coming. I'm probably not gonna see anybody. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's just starting to wear on me. Not to start off on like a sad note, but actually this whole part's going to be sad because there's lots of sad news to report. Mm-hmm. You know, because the pandemic carries on, and we've got Fauci saying this could go to 2022. Yay, that's exciting. Candyman, the new reboot, got bumped indefinitely. Wasn't even given a new date. It's just indefinitely put on hold till 2021 at some point. It's just bad news all around. Tragedy mm-hmm. wherever you look. So how's your day going?
Well, tragedy everywhere you look.
We're going to get a Scream 5, and Neve Campbell is confirmed being in it. So there's an up note. Might be, 2030 before we get it. The Books of Blood, Clive Barker's, it's like collections of stories that have been adapted by Hulu. That teaser came out, so that's exciting. That starts October 5th. Nurse Ratched with Sarah Paulson starts this Friday, September, 18th or something, mm-hmm. 18th or mm-hmm. 19th. So there are things to look forward to lay on your couch and stare into the abyss, while it plays in the background.
The sequel to The Babysitter on Netflix is out.
Yes, that is out now. Very exciting. I have not had a chance to watch it yet. I'm definitely, it kind of sucks. I've been having such a hard time watching new stuff. Like, I really think I'm in that, like, anxiety watch group, where it's like, I don't really want to watch new stuff. I don't know what's going to happen. So it's like, I really am, like, watching stuff I've already seen, I'm trying, we're watching that Raised by Wolves, which I don't even know how to feel about. Such a strange show. Lovecraft Country, although I am behind. Mm-hmm. The Vow, the Nexium docuseries, although I am
behind. Wow, you're watching some dark stuff, like me.
Yeah, I am. Which sometimes is helpful, because it helps me put, perspective mm-hmm. with things, But at the same time, we are all entitled. It's not the Olympics of suffering, of stress or anxiety or whatever, everybody, I don't think it's healthy to compare, our struggles with other people. It can make it worse, because then you're more likely to kind of push down your own anxiety and your own issues because they don't seem as bad as others. And that isn't why I watch that anyways. I watch that out of pure, what the fuckery, about, especially because it's just such a bizarre, that whole story is bizarre with that Nexium cult. It's just bizarre. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so you told me that you've been, because you've been quarantining differently now, right? You've been actually spending time. You guys are in a bubble now. You're doing a bubble.
We're doing a little bubble. I'm coming down to the end of my 2-week quarantine time, which has been really nice because, you know, we haven't spent time like this together for 5 months.
Yeah.
So it's been really nice, you know, and it's fairly banal, but again, like, you know, it feels very normal, and for 5 months of like not feeling normal, that's been really great. So, you know, I make dinner and brunch, and, you know, we've been working from home, together the last week. So, you know, we're on either side of we're on opposite ends of the dining room table, staring at each other. And yeah, it's been good. You know, we made dinner. I made a meatloaf. Thank you, New York Times cooking section. I made meatloaf, and we made dinner together, and it was nice because it was just
you needed the New York Times to help you make a meatloaf.
I have the app, so it's just like I might as well, you know, mine them for stuff.
Was there something special about it? Was there, you know, like
the thing about it's so weird because like I follow recipes, but then I also like don't follow recipes. Like it was like you need like 3 loaves of white sandwich bread, and I didn't have that, but I had King's Hawaiian, so I made it with King's Hawaiian bread instead.
I bet that made it nice, kind of sweet.
Oh yeah, it was very nice. It was very on the sweet side, and I thought about maybe doing like a bacon lattice, but you know we decided not to, and it was good. I adjusted the ratio for the meats, so instead of these New York Times people think they are, but like their recipe calls for 1 pound of veal, so like 1 pound of beef, 1 pound of pork, and 1 pound of veal. I'm just thinking, like, what the hell? Like, that just seems so strange to, like, and veal. And I'm like, okay, well, no, I'm not going to trust the veal from the grocery store, nor am I going to eat veal to begin with. So we just did pork and beef.
Yum. Yeah, sounds good. No, it's just because it's funny because, like, meatloaf is such a, like, a thing that I grew up with that I always hated because it was just so, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's basically a hamburger just in a, you know, a loaf form. But, you know, they always put lots of onions in it when I was growing up, and I hate that, so I never liked meatloaf. But also there's a very famous episode of Roseanne where she teaches a class, like the home ec class, how to make meatloaf, you know, and it's like meat and some cornflakes, and you put it in the oven. Like, you know, it's just like this most simple recipe. It's like, what on earth is the New York Times done to meatloaf? You know, like, well, of course, that makes sense. 3 different meats, you know, fresh grown herbs or something, you know.
And it's
just
totally
go out to your garden in the Hamptons and grab an onion or two.
it's totally that, though, Joshua, because it's like it's not like they have just the recipe that just says meatloaf, and then they have, like, you know, if you want to, like, eat Bill Blass's meatloaf. And I'm like, I don't want to eat Bill Blass's meatloaf. I don't like his jeans. Like, I can't, you know. Or like, it's always fun to see like those kinds of things that they have there. But it was good. It was tasty. He roasted asparagus and made some mashed potatoes, and then I did a mushroom gravy. Like, it was a nice little to-do. We watched Disney movies. Yeah. It's been nice.
That is sweet.
Really enjoying this time. There's some normalcy. But, you know, lamenting, you know, how it's been nice, the two of us, but, like, we do miss coming over and, you know, being with you and playing cards.
I know, same. It sucks. And people, like, hit you up because it's like they're, you know, like, we want to do stuff, but it's like, you know, you think like, yeah, let's plan something. And then you read another story about a small gathering erupting into, you know, hundreds of cases of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, you know, I don't know. I just don't know what to think anymore.
Yeah. I don't.
I mean, you try to stay positive and you try to, you know, do it, but it's just, you know, it's just been weighing on me a little bit more. So I think obviously just approaching the holidays and thinking about this continuing is just like, ugh, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think where you are right now is where I started to be like maybe a month ago.
Yeah.
because like I was just, it was just starting to really hit me, and just not even the fact that it had been going on, it's just like I was just starting to get really exhausted from not being able to, you know, be with people, and especially my love and all that stuff. So, you know,
I think it'll pass, you know what I mean? It's like, you just got to have these dips, you know, sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not going to encourage me to do it. Like, I'm not going out to restaurants. I'm not going to not be wearing my mask. You know, I mean, I'm going to, you know, still, like, I'm not suicidal. You know, it's like, I don't, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's not that serious, or is that serious, you know, I mean, who knows, you know, with this, the COVID thing, you know, but I think it's all right to just be like, man, it's tough, you know, especially on, you know, a lot of us that want to, you know, that are very out, very, very social. You know, I miss the band. I miss playing music. That's been really tough. And now I'm kind of depressed with Facebook's whole thing about, you know, I should have been taking advantage of it, but I've been too kind of down. I haven't been playing, you know, live stream shows, and now Facebook is basically going to ban those. So it's like, you know, it's just a lot of frustrations this week, but again, we have things to look forward to. You know, there's going to be some fun new shows, more new distractions. I'm very excited because I got, I think a year or so ago, I talked about on the show, this book, Death, A Graveside Companion, which was edited by Joanna Ebenstein, based on work from the Richard Harris Art Collection, just tons of different, you know, depictions of death in art and, you know, sort of our relationship with death, you know, as humans and, you know, in art. And she's putting out a new book called Anatomica, The Exquisite and Unsettling Art of Human Anatomy. And there's going to be a symposium. So the author, Joanna Ebenstein, she has a blog called Morbid Anatomy, mm-hmm. Surveying the interstices of art and medicine, death and culture. So obviously right up my alley. And there's going to be a full day symposium to celebrate the release of the book. It's going to be Saturday, September 26th from 12 to 5:30 Eastern Standard Time. So whatever time that is here. Oh man, I'm going to have to get up early that Saturday. but they've got all kinds of people that are going to be giving these different talks, about, anatomy and, you know, throughout history, how we've drawn and sketched the human body, how our understanding of it has changed over the years. So I'm really looking forward to that. So I did want to throw that out. Plus the book looks really cool. Mm-hmm. It has some really interesting drawings and really interesting, you know, from the samples that they've put out of just human, how we have shaped and changed, mm-hmm. with science and, you know, biology and, you know, medicine, how we've developed, a better understanding of the body, and probably how there's still a lot of stuff we don't understand. So that's something I'm looking forward to. Doesn't that sound fun? You're like, no.
It's a book, Joshua. How excited can I get about a book?
But it's pictures. It's like hundreds of pictures, so it's okay.
Okay, that makes it a little bit better.
I'm sure there'll be a few essays, but you can skip them. You can just look at the pictures. I actually have some really cool anatomy books, so I'm excited to add that one to my collection. Which you can't tell, but I cleaned up the library. I've been reorganizing it again.
Oh my gosh.
It's getting out of hand. I decided all the vampire books needed their own section. so I started cleaning things up. I tell you, it's just an ever evolving thing.
I love it.
Yeah, but you can't tell.
I can't tell. It looks the same. So,
and I need to add more books because of our, obviously today we're joined again in the second half of this episode by Heather Petrocelli to discuss Dead Alive, Brain Dead, mm-hmm. Peter Jackson film. And she mentioned a couple of books I don't own. So,
Of course you own them.
Well, no, not yet, but I'm going to. I've got to add them to the shelves, so I had to find a place where I'm going to put them. And in my ever-growing collection of horror and scary studies, you know, it's a reference section. It's a nice reference library.
I do want to give a little shout-out to, because Heather When we recorded this, it was prior to the, you know, huge conflagration in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just give a shout out to, I checked in with her a little bit yesterday, so they're doing okay, you know, as best it can be. But we're just giving a, you know, thinking good thoughts for everybody that's up there, trying, hopefully they're safe and as safe as possible. And, you know, again, this is, it's just nature reflecting back to us.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. Geez, we haven't even like touched on that. Yeah, I mean, there is so much. There's just so much happening right now. It's just a very stressful, intense time on a lot of fronts. And, you know, people are really surviving. I mean, it speaks to our resiliency as a species, you know, that we're, you know, people are doing their best under the circumstances, you know, and even if they're not doing their best, that's fine. You know, but just living right now, you know, and getting through the day is an accomplishment, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, you know, try, I don't know. It's like, I want to be positive, but I also want to, I don't know, just accept stuff. I don't know. I'm sorry, Joe, that I'm trying. I'm trying to stay
up. No, you're fine. You're fine. I am, Joshua, I expect nothing less. I mean, and I say that with all honesty, because it's just like, you know, it's like you can put your head in the sand, you know, or we can just kind of like, this is what's going on, and we could just kind of accept that this is what's happening. And, you know, because in absence of people trying to care for each other, you know, we have to take care of ourselves and the people around us. And I say that, like, just being, knowing that, like, the people out there who are like, this is a hoax, not wearing masks, that sort of thing is, you know, a very vocal minority for the most part. But, you know, I also know that there's people like, you know, they're doing, I can't fault anybody for, I think I mentioned this a few months ago, but like, you know, I just couldn't imagine what it would be like for people to like feel comfortable getting away, like going places and not even just like restaurants, but like getting out of town or whatever. And now I'm just kind of like, you know what, if people feel that that's okay, like if they can be with relative assuredness that, you know, they can and have ability to quarantine in after that, then, you know, you just got to do what you got to do at this point.
Yeah, no, I'm trying not to shame anybody. I mean, I get the outrage I get from people who are upset. Like, I, you know, as always, you know, just because of the kind of person I am, I see the various sides. I see everybody's rage, everybody's, you know, anxiety, you know, or not, like, you know, I get it, you know, I do understand. So it's like, I'm trying to be, come from a place of not shaming. I mean, I want people to be considerate and think of each other and think of themselves and be mindful, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, people have to be, they're responsible for their choices, you know.
Exactly. Like,
and I don't have to live that life, because I am able to stay quarantined and stay, you know, in the situation I'm in.
Exactly. And I, you know, for me, like, I know I'll never, I know that, like, I don't even know when I'll be comfortable sitting at a restaurant ever again. But I know that, like, you know, that hasn't impeded my ability to, like, order out and, you know, reheat food when I come home and still support, and at the very least support local businesses at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Did you do anything fun this week that you want to share? Anything that, you know, so we can end on an up note before we get into our exciting Dead Alive conversation.
I'm trying to think of, you know, it's been nice to like have just really dull nights, and I shouldn't say dull, because, you know, just the fact that we're together has been such a blessing and really worthwhile. But, you know,
feeling, like, that normalization, that like routine.
Exactly. Happiness. Like, you know, we I made one of those like fortune teller cootie catcher things.
yeah.
And this is not, that's not the highlight of my week. But because we got to a point where we were it was difficult for us to kind of decide what to watch. And so, I made one of these fortune teller cookie catcher things and I put like, you know, okay, like, well, if you pick this, it's like, we'll pick something on Disney Plus or pick something on Amazon or on Netflix. And it was just a way to kind of, you know, break it up a little bit and leave it to fate.
I like it. That's fun. That's a good idea, actually, because, you know, it's such first world problems that we have everything, you know, that it's like, exactly. Oh, I can't choose. I can't. Which streaming service? What movie should I watch? What TV show? I just can't. Let's just turn it on.
I know. And then just like, you know, we've been fortunate enough that like, you know, we're just very fortunate. So, you know, we're just enjoying the time together. And
nice. And well, I think that's great.
Yeah. And eventually I'll go back to being with my parents.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure he needs a break from me. But yeah, and then we'll do this again. And I'm going to be back at my parents soon because I want to come back here just in time for like Halloween. Yeah. Because I plan to do my own like little version of Fright School with him.
Cool.
So we'll be watching stuff.
Yay. All right. Well, I like it. I think that's a good place to. I'm actually going to take a week off in October. And I'm thinking about just having like, because I can't do Gorefest this year. I've been thinking about doing like some live streaming or something, you know, of like with people of like things that are on Netflix or on Amazon Prime where we can like watch stuff together, you know, to kind of have that, you know, togetherness for Halloween. Mm-hmm. But, anyways, well, that sounds nice.
The theme is Gorefest isolation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Gorefest pandemic.
Exactly. So, all right, Joe. Well, I think that's a good place to take a quick break, and we will be back with Heather Petruccelli to talk about Dead Alive. Woo!
Meanwhile, in New Jersey.
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie, let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and, ugh, the practical effects. And also the male gaze?
My gaze at the males.
Hi-yo! From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
All right. Welcome back. We are so excited to have back with us Heather Petruccelli to discuss this Peter Jackson masterpiece. New Zealand, I love this, splat stick. That's a great way to describe it. Zombie comedy film. It was released under the title Brain Dead, but in the United States known as Dead Alive. We've all seen kind of the famous poster with the eyeball in the mouth. So very interesting horror film. We've got white peopling. You know, doing stupid things and bringing zombification to the masses. We're just gonna dive in. Joe, we'll start as we always do with your thoughts.
Well, the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, what am I watching? It had similar reaction to this. What was the one we watched with Brennan? What was that one called, Joshua?
Oh, From Beyond.
From Beyond. And then I swear that Lionel was the same actor from Beyond. And then he had like, I haven't seen this film yet, but you know, we go to enough cons that I loosely am aware of it. And then like he brings out the needle and I was like, am I also watching Reanimator? Like I felt like there was a lot of that going on in there because he's similar. But I mean, overall it's fun. It's definitely a fun romp. But like I was just like really glad to have already eaten, as we're watching it. And, It's a lot of close-ups because, like, I watched it with, like, my laptop on my stomach and it was, like, even more insane. Yeah. Like, like, it was just, like, wow, extreme close-up. Immersion. And then it was, I was very immersed in it. This film also has, like, my second favorite kill of all in it. And I'll go into that in a little bit. But yes, so, I mean, I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was definitely just like a giant mindfuck the entire time. But yes.
True.
And then,
true.
And then, of course, you know, our good friends, the like Romany people of of apparently Wellington.
Yeah, the Spanish Romany.
Like the Spanish, like, you know, Spanish Romany, Wellington, New Zealand. I half expected the flying Concords, the Flight of the Concords to come in this thing. It was very New Zealand. It was very white New Zealand, I should say, because, you know, there didn't look like there were many indigenous people in this. But yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I'm really curious to hear more about Heather's connection to it, though.
Absolutely. I had read this interview with you on morbidlybeautiful.com, which we will have linked in the show notes here, should people want to examine it. But you list, so there's like one of those questions, like that typical question of like, what are your favorite like horror movies? And I love like the way that you kind of answer, because it's like, there are films that permanently scarred me after seeing them as a child. And then in parentheses says The Exorcist, films that blew my mind as an adult, Martyrs. And then films that I revisit often, Dead Alive. And that's what we're here to discuss today, because I'm like, oh, The Exorcist, oh, Martyrs, Suspiria, 2018, The Bride of Frankenstein, these like kind of, I think, in a way, highbrow horror films, you know, and then Dead Alive is in. And I'm like, OK, this is awesome, because I haven't seen this movie in years. You know, it's one of those, and I'm pretty sure I've never seen it so unedited, because I'm pretty sure I saw it on television, you know, in the 90s, all cut up. So it was very like, oh man, we're in it deep. So let's talk about your love of it. Why this film, when we go of all the horror that you've watched and discussed? Dead Alive.
I brought Dead Alive specifically because when Joe and I were having our conversation doing the interview, it came out in the interview that Joe enjoyed horror comedies and that Joe, I thought in my head, enjoyed gore. On revisiting that, Joe said the opposite.
It can go either way, but yeah.
Yes, and I get that now, but in my head, and I just said, I usually don't try to interject myself, like, but have you seen Dead Alive? And Joe said no. And so when we stopped recording, I said, you need to see Dead Alive. And that's why I picked it, I think, because I just thought, well, Joe should see Dead Alive. And for me, when I was in high school, I saw Meet the Feebles. And man, like, Heidi, mwah, like, I love Meet the Feebles. And so then I found a bootleg copy of Bad Taste. And I was like, oh my God, who is this guy? I love this guy. And then Dead Alive was coming out. And I went and saw it, had its premiere here. And I belly laughed through the whole thing. I still belly laugh through the whole thing. And it's so audacious in its gore. And I love, love, love practical effects. Mm-hmm. And it's before CGI took over. And Richard Taylor is a effects genius and, you know, went on to win lots of Oscars for Lord of the Rings. So I think that's like, just like, it's a movie that when I was a young person, I loved. I've seen it many times in the movie theater, and I've seen it a number of times with almost exclusively queer audiences. And it's just one of my favorite memories of life. Like, I just love seeing Dead Alive with a queer audience.
Oh, see, and I firmly believe that, like, it's like, if anyone is going to show, like, one of the truest, like, things you can do to care for another person is to recommend to them something like a television show or a movie that is very close to you in the hopes that they also, you know, love it as much as you do. And so, like, I was like, man, I really do love Heather. Like, if this was like, I was like, all horror films, all queer films ever. And it was like, you got to watch Dead Alive. And I was like, this is great. And because the thing is, like, it took me a little bit because I had to decide, because I didn't read anything about it. I was just, let me just go into it. And it took me maybe like 30 minutes in to decide that they're being humorous, because I just thought they were being thought it was just that dry humor of like that dry Commonwealth humor. and I thought that like, okay, maybe they're just, and then I was like, no, this is going to be something that's like, this is a choice. And I was just like watching this and I'm just like, you know, it's so funny because like I'm used to at this point, you know, Joshua saying like, oh, I put this film on for a rainy day. You know, this is my rainy day film, and it's The Witch, and it's, you know, like I'm used to like, you know, everyday kind of, you know, I put the Gilmore Girls on in Frasier, and you know, people put on Dead Alive or The Witch, and I'm just like, okay, that's I totally get it. But like watching this film, I was just kind of, I didn't think I had to remind myself this was 1992. Like this was released in 92, because it was definitely before, like this was before its time in my mind. Like this film felt very much before its time, not just in practical effects, but like in just like how it was shot and lighting and everything. Like, it was very impressive in that way too. Like from a filmmaking standpoint, it was also very impressive, but it did make me like love you more. Cause I'm like, I was like, yeah, all right. Like I love that this is your one of the, those like favorite types of film. Like I tell people to watch Mrs. Doubtfire all the time. I don't know what that says about me, but like, or maybe I know exactly what that says about me.
I think, yeah, it says about we deal with our trauma differently. Yeah,
exactly.
Like we went to New Zealand in 2016, and I'm just going to say maybe I made Ami go on a tour with me to all of the Dead Alive sites in Wellington.
That's awesome.
That so, is amazing.
Is that house, does that house exist somewhere?
Oh yeah, I can send you a photo of it. I found it.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, that we went.
Way cool.
Yeah, we went to. I found the house. We went to the botanical gardens where the scene with the baby takes place. We went to the cemetery to find. Because actually, it's interesting. The film actually caused there was a lawsuit against Wignut Pictures because when I Kick Ass for the Lord, you can see like one tombstone with a real name, Bradley. So Bradley's family sued. They didn't win this, but it set into motion a new law in New Zealand. So you can't, it's a privacy violation to show names on tombstones, but we went and violated it and found Bradley. and then my favorite place was what are they called? The Pentacles, the opening scene of the film. I think they're called Pentacles. Yeah. I think they're called the Pentacles. And it was one of the craziest places I've ever been. It's like a really eerie, when you're in there in those, whatever those formations are, it's a really eerie place. So that's how much I love Dead Alive.
That is amazing. I love, definitely. If you have pictures, send them to us.
I totally will. I'll totally send you pictures.
So real quick for our dear listener who is maybe has seen this 1,000 times or never at all. I should have done this, you know, at the beginning of this, a quick synopsis of the film. overprotective mother, Vera Cosgrove, played here by Elizabeth Moody, spying on her grown son, Lionel, Timothy Baum. Is it Baum? Is that how you say that? Has an E at the end. So I imagine as he visits the zoo with the lovely Paquita, Diana Pinalver. Sorry, I butchered that, is accidentally bitten by the fearsome Sumatran rat monkey. When the bite turns his beloved mother into a zombie, Lionel tries to keep her locked safely in the basement. But her repeated escapes turn most of the neighbors into the walking dead, who then crash a high society party, which I have to disagree with that. But anyways, high society party thrown by Lionel's boorish uncle Les, played here by Ian Watkins. So that kind of, that's basically what happens, but does not at all start to scratch the surface for what happens in this film.
I just also like, it's a film. I'm just going to like nerd out in this film because I just love it so much.
Yeah.
It's also a film that has so many layers. So you have the layers of Peter Jackson, who's clearly a film fan, clearly a horror fan. So you have all these little nuggets throughout the film that are nods to films past, just the fact that it's Skull Island and King Kong. And then we know that he went on to, he had a childhood fascination, went on to make not a great version of King Kong.
Because this is set in the 50s, right?
It's 57, which is important because it's the last year that there was a celebration of Empire Day. And I do think that this movie is an entire like island colony tale about.
Yes.
So I think it's important. I don't think it's a mistake or an accident that it's like 57.
I wrote down some stuff about that. So I'm very excited you bring that up, but go ahead.
Well, it's awesome. It's just like, it's a like splatstick period piece. What? It's like so many things. And then we can talk about all kinds of horror theory using this film because you have affect theory, you have abject theory, you have the monstrous feminine. We can keep talking and talking about this stuff. So I'll stop now.
No, absolutely. And that's what we do here, you know, take a film and, you know, talk about what it could possibly mean. I love that it's set in the 50s too, because it feels like those kind of 50s monster movies, only this is what like mothers like at that time thought these movies were like. It's like, you know, that they were this bloody and gory and gross when they couldn't even touch this, like with the levels of horror that is happening. I really enjoyed it for that overall, like that feeling of like, this is like a drive-in movie in the 50s, like just something that, you know, it's just very transgressive for the time, but only in the 90s. I wrote some stuff down. I wrote the thing, like, obviously it's got that, there's so much, what do you want to say? Lots of tropes in this, like, you know, researcher / scientist / whatever, you know, going into the unknown place and taking something from it that's dangerous, but, you know, he can control it, only obviously not. That's why I'm saying white peopling. You do have that like overbearing mother, King Kong, I wrote down King Kong, I wrote down Psycho. I also wrote down The Wall, Pink Floyd's The Wall, because it just kind of reminded me, especially at the end with the like monstrous mother figure, just kind of like, I'm like, wow, there's a lot happening here. I'm very curious about Peter Jackson's relationship with his mother. I love the way the rat monkey thing looks. It reminded me of the Grand High Witch Rat and the witches. Yep. Like, it's so like creepy. So let's just kind of get into that, talking about, what is this movie about? So you brought up Empire Day. So let's explore that a little bit more.
So the monstrous feminine comes from a scholar named Barbara Creed, who I think she's Australian, but maybe she's not. I know she teaches in Australia, in Melbourne, I believe. And she has written an article, I can't remember when it came out, but sometime between when the movie came out and well over a decade ago. She wrote a whole piece about how Peter Jackson's films are constantly dealing with themes of New Zealand as an island colony and trying to flip the script. So it's complicated because he renders invisible the indigenous people, but to deal with the bullshit of the actual colonizers and what's left behind. And so he, instead of having the savage, you know, native, as happens a lot in these stories, he's trying to show that it's actually the British people who are the picture of respectability who are actually the savage and, you know, barbaric ones. And, you know, starting off with the zoo, you know, the zoo official who has his papers to come, you know, take this, you know, revered rat monkey from an island off of, or, you know, Skull Island. So I think it's interesting to think about it in that way. So there's the bigger picture of like, and when Barbara Creed's talking about Peter Jackson, she is talking specifically about Bad Taste, Brain Dead there, you know, Dead Alive here, and Heavenly Creatures as stories that show this split between the, you know, lots of like using lots of scare quotes, air quotes here, but the motherland, the colonizer versus the colony. So I specifically also, because of our interview, Joe, I wanted to have your take on it as someone from a colonized island.
One thing that I thought was very subtle, and I don't know if this is intentional or what have you, but one thing that I thought was really interesting was when Vera's like, anytime that Vera was talking to Lionel this entire time, like Lionel has a very Kiwi accent. Like, it's a very, New Zealand accent. But when Vera is talking, she has this like affected English, like highborn English accent. It's not it's unless that she's really upset, and then it kind of comes out. The Kiwi accent comes out a little bit, and I'm just thinking, like, I wonder if that was intentional, or if that was because she's almost like, you know, I don't want to be. And then I had this thought where I was like, well, you know, I mean, you can't be too highfalutin, because I know that like people who are brought to that area of the world were not usually necessarily the best. You know, they weren't sending their best. So, so it's like, why? All of that. So like, I thought that was really interesting. And then in the beginning, when he's showing his permit, that's when I was like, is this funny? And I'm like, cause that's really funny to me that you're just showing these indigenous people your permit. And it just kind of reminds me of like, you know, the, like, it's like, just leave well enough alone, white man. Like, if you had just left well enough alone, like, we know how to do things here. Just leave it alone. But no, let's just take it. And then he ends up getting, you know, he gets his, you know, that's too late for everybody else. But, you know, he'll get his. Which is really fascinating, because it's like, there are no... It's like very noticeably absent to me. Like there were no, like, you know, the indigenous people of even Paquita, like Paquita's, you know, Latinx, Romani, like, which was just like, I don't know how, like, just like her story of getting there to New Zealand is something I want to explore. But the absence of indigenous faces, but at the same time, like, that's, I didn't even put that together until you said it, like the idea, like, oh, the absence, but like these people are the monsters, is really interesting and fascinating.
Yeah, no, I think there's this one moment where, you know, and that's the beauty of film. This is one of the reasons I love film. It's like, was that specific slippage of dialect for Vera purposeful, or was an accidental? Does it matter actually in some ways? Because it exists. Mm-hmm. And I love when Vera is like, after she's, you know, been bitten, and she's like, it's the W-L-W-L. And I just always think that that means, it's like, I forget actually for all the times I've seen it, because all I ever hear is that it's basically for the white ladies who lunch.
Yep.
And I think that it is built into it. So one thing, that there are many, many cuts of this film, because this film being one of the goriest films ever created, like, I think there was something like close to 80 gallons of blood used in this film. And it's still banned in countries today, which to me is so fucking ridiculous. But
felt terrible for the actor sometimes. So it must have been so sticky and gross and yeah. Smelly. Ugh.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
I know that it's the UK version, but I think it's the UK and Commonwealth versions where the film opens with a whole, like, there's a more direct Queen Elizabeth, like Queen Elizabeth opens the film, and it's her in some parade or some Commonwealthy empire crap that I don't know. But I think that with that being cut from, you know, the US Dead Alive version, and I do think that the US 97 minute cut is Peter Jackson's favorite cut of the film, it takes away some more of the explicit trying to tell the story of, like, basically British exploiter colony. But what do we do with the colonies where, I wrote down a quote that Barbara Creed had said, because I thought it was interesting. In colonies like New Zealand, the desire of occupants to remain attached to the mother country is equaled only by the determination of the home country to not let go. And Vera is that's her role in this film. And that's why she's the main monster of that switches. So all of that British civilization, they're the barbaric monsters. So I think it's a very interesting take on it. I do think there's, you know, some problematic stuff with the depictions of the indigenous people in the beginning of the film that definitely just does not age well. It always made me a little bit uncomfortable, but, you know, I always believed in the intention behind it. So I'm curious more about your guys' thoughts about that.
No, I think, yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. I was going to say my third note was like zombie as racist slash colonizer. And then the note just a little bit farther down is, it's interesting, the juxtaposition of this quote unquote love scene between Lionel and is it Paquita?
Paquita, yeah.
With as the mother is changing more and more into this like monstrous zombie, I thought was a very, you know, I was like, it just seemed like that pull, you know, towards like, you know, between like what you're saying, you know, of staying, I don't want to say it, because it's like, I don't want to say like being a zombie is normal. It's like, but it's her anger. It's that anger and that uncomfortableness with the other and her son, like, you know, becoming involved with this, you know, woman is like kind of growing in her. And then literally, you know, she's becoming this monster while he's like finding this love, you know. I just think that, you know, kind of goes to that sort of point about the film, kind of talking about colonization, racism, England, did all of that same kind of bullshit. Like, I don't know exactly how to put it either, because I don't really, and I wish that I knew more, because here in America, like, obviously I grew up in America, I'm well aware of our history for the most part, as much of it has been lied to to me about, you know, so kind of unpacking, so it's easy to kind of contextualize films within American racism, you know, and systems of racism here in America, you know, for American horror. So I don't know as much about New Zealand, you know, or exactly, you know, but I imagine it's similar. You know, I imagine that colonization, you know, of indigenous people and kind of pushing them out, that there's a similar tension. So that's kind of why I, like, immediately that was one of the first things I wrote down about it, because I just felt like, oh, obviously we're having a conversation about, you know, dangerous fucking white people.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right in so many ways. And yeah, I do know, I like you, I was raised in the US and my perspectives are US perspectives. I do know that when we went to New Zealand, we had went to Australia first and traveled around for a number of weeks. Then we went to New Zealand, traveled around for a number of weeks. And I can tell you that the felt, like the work that the New Zealanders have done over the decades to try to, I don't even know the right words to use them. I'm going to use the words like reparations, because they actually have some laws to try to do reparations to the Maori people. Mm-hmm. But that history is like as horrific as it is anywhere where a bunch of white colonizers went in. But I think that they have worked really hard to try to reintegrate in Maori culture, language. They have done some reparations. It's not perfect. There's loads and loads of shit that needs still to be done. There's plenty of racism, but it felt night and day compared to dealing with Australians and the Aboriginal peoples there. So, mm-hmm. And it makes me feel like there's something too of film, you know, like Dead Alive now is, it's an old film. I mean, you know, it makes me feel old actually saying that.
Right. Relatively speaking. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's something to the fact that clearly there was a younger generation of New Zealanders trying to figure out, we have this, like, we are an island colony and we have this colonization history, but where can we move forward? And I think that's why it's so important that Paquita is a Spanish Roma, her and her family are Roma people. So I think it's all very interesting. And that's just like the one thing that most people don't even see in that film, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The thing people actually see is the constant gore, which goes more into affect and abject theory. But like, I think it's something I've always actually just kind of thought about, and I appreciate your Jackson.
I think Joshua, you're going to say the same thing. Would you explain a little bit about those theories? Because I don't know if I'm familiar with those.
For the listener.
For the listener. I think the easiest way to break it down is affect theory, you know, with an A, affect, is horror is for horror to be effective, it is affective. It elicits a physical response. Just like you said, Joe, you were glad you were glad you weren't eating, or are you glad you just hadn't eaten?
I'm glad that I had, like, I'm glad that I had already eaten, because if I hadn't, I still wouldn't have for a while.
Yeah. And I had my partner watch it with me, and I was eating watermelon. She was like, how are you eating that fucking watermelon right now? I'm like, I love this stuff. This is great. So that's affect theory, which is more just people who study the people who are in neurocinematics are studying the actual neurological responses that horror elicits.
And those biological.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like horror palation, you know, your hair standing on end. Abject theory is most often attributed to Julia Kristeva, and abject, and she deals, I think, more with literature. So she's not actually dealing with horror films, but it's constantly applied to horror film because it works almost in any world. Abject theory is about liminal spaces of subject and object, and when things are not where they're supposed to be, like pus, shit, blood, guts. Those are all abject because you're kind of drawn to them because they're part of you. But when they're outside of you, they're not part of you. And it's got this weird horror and attraction all wrapped into one. And I mean, again, Dead Alive, how much, sorry, I'm laughing because I just thought of the pus scene is one. I love having people watch that film for the first time when he's like, what, no pudding? And then the pudding comes out and then the pus goes into it and he eats it. That might be the grossest scene in the whole movie to me, because it always makes me think, ugh, but like, that's a perfect example of abject theory.
See, I didn't mind it. I watch pimple popping videos on YouTube.
Oh my God.
So like, I it was gross to me because he ate it, but you know, it was also gross because like he was such an asshole. I was just like, yeah, eat that pus, you piece of shit. Like it's, but like, okay. So thank you, by the way, for those explanations. And I feel like this is why I love horror. Like this is why I love horror. This is why I just love, I love rhetorical criticism to begin with, because it's like if you really want to nerd out, like we can spend like literally hours talking just talking about her accent alone. Like that's like, sometimes I wonder, like I watched Gran Torino in theaters and I was in the middle of my degree program and I was like with my family and I was like, do you like how like his confession at the end was like the screen door and it was like to, you know, cause he didn't give a true confession and now he's giving it and there's the screen and all the, and they were like, it was just a movie. Like, no, there's more to it. There are layers and layers. I wanted to, before we move forward, I want to go back a little bit to what you said about like the representations of like those indigenous people in the beginning.
And
I feel like my feeling with this particular film and Peter Jackson and all of that is that like some, and how I approach kind of like representations of like the cultural or racial other in other films is I always kind of think about like, is this a representation of what the people in the film believe these people to be? So it was like, so like in Dead Alive, it's like, do these people believe that like they're liberating this animal for like the betterment of like civilized society? And so they're taking away from these savages who use it for dark magic, whatever, whatever. And so that's where you get that. And like, it's because it's a commentary more on the world and the world that's being built than it is like, I believe that the filmmaker, the auteur is like, I believe that these people are savages. This is how I want to build it. As opposed to say like a film like, and I'm only saying this because I made my boyfriend watch this last night. Jungle to Jungle, Disney's Jungle to Jungle from the late 90s with Tim Allen. See, Joshua, this is what Joshua fucking lives for when I say shit like this.
This is amazing. This is so amazing. Jungle to Jungle, Dead Alive.
Yeah, exactly.
I cannot wait to see where.
Well, in Jungle to Jungle, he is Tim Allen realizes that his ex-wife, who is a doctor at this like Amazonian tribe, has a son, and so you know she's been raising this like adolescent white boy in a tribe, and so in that regard it's just like, oh, this is the filmmaker, even in a narrative sense, trying to be like a documentary, like trying to present, you know, things as they are and not necessarily like trying to comment, whereas like the Dead Alive world is heightened, it's a commentary, it's splatstick, it's all of these things, it's camp, it's all of these things, as opposed, but like you're trying to play it really straight, you know, for better or worse, really strayed in Jungle to Jungle. And then that's where the problematic things like come in, you know, and it's just like, you're trying to be respectful, but in trying to be respectful, you're also like tokenizing, you're also exploiting these people as well, othering them in a way that is even grosser than like the less than 5 minutes that those people in Dead Alive get to.
Yeah, no, I think that's in the way I always kind of reconciled it in my head was that in the end, that is absolutely a narrative about the colonial exploiters becoming the zombies, which is also a take on the fact that what did you have to do as a human to be a colonial exploiter in the first place? I mean, talking about like real people, like there's a lack of humanity that is somehow needed that has a zombie-like effect to it. And then the fact that like we can get into like, especially since you're studying psychology, we can get into the Freudian aspects of all of this stuff too. And people, I'm sure, have written pages and pages on the Freudian ending of the film. But to me, that ending is really about releasing themselves from the shackles of their, you know, Empire Day British colony past and moving forward into their, you know, more diverse, you know, with his Spanish Romany family, new in-laws.
Mystical family.
I mean, that's so awesome too, because like so Barbara Creed said all that stuff about Peter Jackson because she's written about Peter Jackson, but Barbara Creed is probably most famous in horror for her monstrous feminine theory. And she has 7 points of the monstrous feminine, which at its base is essentially, these are taking complex theories and making them one sentences, but the main point is that when the woman is the monster, it creates a different fear in people, specifically men, than when the male is the monster. Right. And so she has 4 different archetypes of the monstrous feminine. I think all 7 exist in this film. And I think that's also amazing that like, I can't name loads of films where all 7 exist in one film. So.
Oh my gosh. So much was said like just there. But then I'm like, okay, wait, what do I want to talk about first? Cause I love that, you know, talking about like what we have to do to like dehumanize ourselves. Cause I've been talking about that in the context of a lot of this, like the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of this conversation about like the poor are humans. If I have to explain this to you, if I have to explain that Black people are real and are as complicated and are as, you know, as loving and as an intense a person as you are, if I explain that women and their bodies deserve, you know, I don't know how to explain that to you. I don't know how to make you see that is a true case. So the idea like that is a zombie, like that sort of no empathy. I have absolved myself of empathy and humanity in order to subjugate people for my own pleasure, my own comfort, my own privilege, you know, like that is monstrous, you know. And I've had this conversation with lots of close people to me, as we do, family, blood, you know, where it's like, I cannot make you understand how inhuman you're being and you don't see it. And the fact that you don't see it means we cannot have this conversation, you know? So I love that so much in context of this, in context of colonization. And yeah, the monstrous feminine, certainly that's why it's like, I wrote The Wall Down, which that whole album, yes, it's about, you know, the album and the film, yes, it's about the price of fame and it's about, you know, what, you know, this poor rich white man and, you know, his struggles, you know, but it's also about the overbearing mother and it's about, you know, his inability to like form healthy relationships with women or with, you know, partners. And you don't use, I saw that reflected in here. And then very literally in the end, when she, you know, the mother bursts through the end as this monstrous, enormous, like puppet, you know, it just felt very much like The Wall, which, you know, I feel speaks to its end. Then again, Psycho with those complicated relationships with, you know, with mother and, yes, and ill child. You know, so yeah, I definitely think there's a lot to be unpacked here within the monstrous feminine. Do you think that Paquita, like, is she playing some sort of role in that too? Or is it more of her, is that her grandmother or mother who's like telling the fortune? Like, are you including them within those contexts? Like, I'm trying to see how all the different ways the monstrous feminine plays.
Yeah, I think that I always assumed it was her grandmother, but she actually, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I think she actually makes reference, and I feel like now I'm thinking she says mother, but I'm pretty sure it's her grandmother. I feel like she plays the witch role in the film, as you know, and I mean, and that is all the coding, right? Like the father figure makes a kind of undercurrent reference to them moving all the time, and then the grandmother has her, you know, Aleister Crowley deck of tarot cards, like,
right?
So,
oh my gosh. No, I was like, oh wow, this is a dark tarot deck.
I think that I'm trying to remember. I went to the Peter, was it in the Peter Jackson Museum? There's a museum that I went to. I'm trying to remember where I learned this, but I know that the deck was mostly intact, but they made two or three cards were created for the film that aren't actually in the actual tarot deck. I don't know why I'm telling you that.
No, it's okay. To serve the story, you know what I mean? That it was, you know, obviously they got to do their story stuff.
They got to make up some stuff here. Right. So I think that the coding is in there for that's how we know. Cause I don't think it's never explicitly said that they're Roma people. Right. So that's coding. And she is witch-like in her, you know, she's just missing her, you know, crystal ball.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then there would be like a Scooby-Doo episode. But I think that it's necessary for that family to be the family, because in the end, when you pay attention to the narrative, that is the only reason that Lionel survives. Like he survives because of the wisdom of that. It's hard on a podcast for people to see the ethnic family.
Right.
That is why he survives. And they're people who are clearly outsiders to that land. They are neither Maori people, nor are they the European colonizers. They are people who have been subjugated in many countries throughout Europe for centuries. Mm-hmm.
And they are, you know, and because of that, they are outsiders to the colonizers. Like, you know, in the homeland of the colonizers, they are the outsiders.
Exactly.
Even though, oddly enough, by moving to New Zealand, they are also settler. They're also settler colonizers as well.
They're like refugees, you know, in the context of being pushed out of other colonized countries.
But yeah, let's just pretend that they're coded as Spanish Roma people, Spanish Roma family. Maybe they were running from basically the dictatorship of Franco or something.
Yeah, because we're saying this is 57, so yeah, there's like historical context there that we could be assuming about the story.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly.
I'm not saying I know exactly, but I'm like, obviously there's something, you know, there can be conversation there. I'm sure.
It's like your friend. There's someone out there going to be like, Jesus Christ, it's just a like orgy of gore. Enjoy it.
Right. But like, that's the beauty of the beauty of rhetorical criticism, but like the beauty of this show, the beauty of horror in general is that like, if you just go a little deeper, you know, if you just go a little bit deeper, you can, like, does it stand as itself just like a gore film? Yes, it does. But like, if you want to have, you can get more enjoyment of it there. Both things can be true. This can be like a very scathing indictment of settler colonialism. And then it can also be just like this huge gore fest comedy. To kind of bring it to a little bit, to kind of go back to the horror and not be as like, you know, fancy in our thinking about things. I mentioned that this is my second favorite kill is in this. Is in this, and my second favorite kill. My first favorite kill, Joshua, was in 13 Ghosts, the guy who gets killed with the sliding glass door.
Oh, yeah, split in half.
Yes, that was the first favorite kill for those keeping score at home. My second favorite kill is, I think it's one of the party goers. It's the blonde woman in the red dress. And then one of the hoodlum zombies punches
the greasers,
her.
You mean?
One of those greasers. In Wikipedia, it had them as hoodlum.
Okay.
But I mean,
I wrote down greasers with a question mark and exclamation point. I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
But like the greaser people, he like punches her through the back of her head, and a fist comes out of her mouth. And I was like, yes, this. It also like this is a great kill. I mean, like, right underneath that would be the baby coming out of the woman, like the woman with the glasses, her face.
Oh, Lord.
Which was terrifying. But again, like, I think that particular kill, just like, because it was so, it, like, it, you knew, like, you could see that it was a fake, like it was a practical effect. You could see it was an effect, but like it happened so quickly that like I was like, "Oh shit, did he really do that?" And then as you know, he keeps going. So yeah, so that would probably be my second favorite kill of all of Fright School. Would that be that right there?
That makes me so happy.
Yeah,
that fucking garbage pail monster baby thing. Oh my Lord. And the whole like taking it out to like the park, like it was just like, what in the hell?
That's like one of my favorite scenes, that park scene. And it was filmed, I think, last because he came in under budget and he had eight left over because, you know, New Zealand supports its film, and they had a, you know, he received funding from the New Zealand Film Commission to make the film, and he went and did that scene, which I'm so happy it exists, because it makes me laugh. I mean,
it's wild.
I love seeing a baby be beat up.
Yeah.
Heather, I just wrote, children are scary as hell and gross. Like, this is why I don't have any. Go ahead, Joseph.
Heather, please correct me if I'm wrong, but the martial arts fight scene in the cemetery, does the priest say something along the lines of like, I'm an ass kicker for the Lord?
I kick ass for the Lord.
I kick ass for the Lord. Thank you. I was like,
I wrote that down too. I'm like, really? We need a t-shirt.
I was like, we need a t-shirt that says, I kick ass for the Lord. But like in that like New Zealand, like I kick ass for the Lord.
Exactly. No, it's, I think the thing, especially when you see it in really big crowds, especially queer crowds, you get the, everyone tense, I kick ass for the Lord. Everyone says, your mother ate my dog. And then not all of it. And then everyone has, no one will ever love you like your mother, as her monstrous womb literally opens up and swallows him whole.
Yes. So real quick, I we always are like, oh, this will be quick. But no. I'm curious. So I, watching this film, like I feel like I saw a picture, like in your presentation where this was in, like there was a picture of this, like a picture of Lionel included with some of the other queer. And I'm just wondering like how the queer reading of this film, you know, cause you're talking about seeing it with queer audiences. And this is something that I feel like we've talked to lots of queer people about and it's never come up. So I'm just wondering about your thoughts on the queerness of Dead Alive.
I think,
why would it appeal?
I think it appeals basically because of something that Joe said. And let's be real, like Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh, this is a straight couple, but this is a campy, campy, over the top, excessive film. Like, I think you, Joshua, had mentioned like you felt sorry for the actors because that must have been such a uncomfortable shoot. I mean, you literally see them slipping and sliding constantly in that last scene with like their 80 gallons of blood. And I think there's something to the audaciousness of creating something so ridiculously over the top that also is constantly speaking to something smarter underneath about the other. And whenever you talk about the other, that's the beauty of being othered. And there's so many different, like with people's intersectional realities, those others are come into play in different ways and at different times and in different contexts. But whenever you're dealing with the other, if you are an other, you can find yourself in there somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, so Joe looked like you were going to say something.
Oh, no, I was agreeing. I was like, yes, church, church. Yes.
So I think for me, I am a human who believes that camp is a queer language. I believe that straight people have co-opted it and used it. Peter Jackson is a straight person that's used it. I think that there's definitely something to be said for the camp of the GOP, except there's no joy to it. So I have a little bit of issue with what, I'll say it differently. People are arguing about the camp of the GOP and how it's no longer a queer thing. And my argument is, there is a joy. We had it as a language, as a communication device for survival for a long time because we were relegated to the shadows. the GOP, there is a level of camp, but I don't, it has to have a new word created for it because it's lacking joy. So there's a joyousness to the ridiculousness and over the top gore. Like everything we talked about, like the number of, like the amount of blood, pus, guts, skeletons, whatever you want to name. I can't think of a film that does it in a more joyful, campy way. And there, you know, and that's like, and I'm someone who, I love the original Evil Dead. I love Evil Dead 2. There's lots of homages to the film. Like the guy who takes a picture at the zoo, you know, like that one guy when like Vera smashes the the rat monkey and the guy takes a picture. That's Forrest Ackerman, who, I don't know if you guys know Forrest, but Forrest created the famous Monsters of Filmland. And he used to have a long time ago, you could kind of find his house and it was kind of an impromptu museum. And
oh, cool.
I went to his house once. So it's just a movie that has so much, the love of horror is clear in it. Like the baby itself is like a throwback nod to Larry Cohen's It's Alive from 74.
Yeah.
So there's just like a love that when something also, it's like another layer that's a less queer layer, but it's a layer that still speaks to queers because it's like someone who just love you. You know, Peter Jackson loves horror films because of the way he just makes these little cinematic citations throughout. So that's my not quick answer.
Heather, so, you know, Peter Jackson loves horror films, and you saying that brings, I want to get your thoughts on this. Is it possible to be a horror film director, or even very simply a person who loves horror films, and also be a person who is homophobic? Speaking from an artistic standpoint, is it possible to love horror, to work in horror, and to be someone who is homophobic? But is it also possible to be a fan and be a person who like loves horror as a fan, and then be homophobic as well? Like, I mean, I'm
absolutely
sure.
Absolutely. The answer is yes.
Yes. I mean, like, we contain multitudes. Yes.
Yes. I call them the straight white horror bro. And when I first went away, was this in college? When I was young, I was a teenager. I was actually still a teenager. And I went to my first Fangoria Weekend of Horrors. And I remember walking into the space and having a incredibly visceral response of like, I do not belong here. And it was actually genuinely heartbreaking because I was like, when it's something that means so much to you and you feel like it's actually part of who you are in a way, like horror as a genre. And then you realize that the most vocal, at least at that time, the most vocal fan base had constant misogyny, constant racism, and constant homophobia. And I think that things are better. I think that queer horror fans, like, you know, going back to something that we said, I think in our last chat, I actually wrote this, and Joshua had brought this up. Robin Wood, a queer theorist, a queer critic, film critic, has a theory about the return of the repressed. And I am writing about how this whole movement for horror is queer, period, is an entire repressed community coming back to claim horror as its own. So those voices that are racist, are homophobic, are misogynistic will be the minority, and there are plenty of straight people who are not homophobic, not racist, and not misogynist, or at least not outwardly. We all have it all built
not in. Maliciously.
Yeah. We all have it all of us have it all built into us. No matter what you are, we all have all of it built into us. There is space for those kinds of people too. But I still think that those people, we still relate to the genre, the film, the text in front of us, I still feel like we relate to it a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Did I answer your question, Joe?
Yeah, it did. It did. Okay. I you know, I'm surrounded right now by such, you know, queer horror goodness that I completely forgot that the bros exist.
No, I think it's important to remember they totally exist, and they still tend to dominate, actually. And I think it's something really important to talk about, and it needs to be a bigger conversation about it, because I have done. I think you were my 13th, 14th interview. Everyone talks about entering a space at some point in time, and whatever it is that your personal intersect, every single person I'm talking to is queer, whatever other others you carry with you, every single person has had an experience of walking into a mainstream horror space and being like, what the fuck? Come on, man. Seriously, white straight horror bros? Really? So, and I think that that definitely needs to, that era needs to come to a screeching halt, especially for a genre that deserves so much more. And it's a complicated genre because it's so easy for feminists to tear it apart. It hasn't been kind to women. It hasn't been kind to people of color. It hasn't been kind to queers. So it's a really weird thing to be, you know, two of those things and fight for a genre that I still think is transgressive and queer at its core. But I just want to see, mm-hmm. I'm really interested in where we keep going. I want to see it keep pushing forward.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love all of it because it is, you're 100% right. It's sometimes, you know, and I've had those conversations with my friends who, you know, we're all very truly left, very politically left, where it's like, you know, you call yourself a feminist and you love horror. You say you're anti-racist and you love horror. You say, you know, whatever, you know, you're supposed. And it's like, yeah, because I see the potential and I see what has been said and what is there, you know, and just because a bunch of assholes, you know, like anything, white straight guys dominate, you know, they're telling those stories, but there's plenty of space for ours and they're there, you know? So sometimes I'm packing it and talking about it and also broadening what horror means, you know, to people. That also, I think, kind of opens minds about how it truly is functioning in our art culture in so many ways that people just don't even think about. You know, they think they hear horror, they think, you know, Splatter, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Friday the 13th. You know, not that those films don't obviously have space and we can talk about them and love them for all their flaws, you know, but it also is, you know, Silence of the Lambs and Hereditary and The Witch and things that are, and Suspiria, you know, that are speaking to these incredible conversations about feminism or about, you know, being, you know, a woman or being queer or being, you know, a person of color, being black. So there's just so much space. And like you said earlier, it is such a litmus test to see where we're at in culture. You know, you pull a horror film from any year that it's produced and you could say, oh my gosh, this is what was happening that year. And the 10 years before it, you know, this is what that person was exposed to. And that's what they're talking about now. I mean, it's yeah, very, very incredible. And just so, I mean, we always like laugh like, oh, we're going to run out of things to talk about on the show. And we never do. There's always something more, you know, yeah. And especially having awesome guests like you come on and bring a movie that I would have never chosen. You know, I mean, just simply also because I do get a little afraid of showing Joe stuff that's a little really gory. You know, like I'd like to do Martyrs, but we're going to have to find that 30-minute made-for-TV cut of it in order for Joe to watch it because it's a different kind of gore, which that's the other thing. This is cartoonish. This is Looney Tunes. This is camp.
This is camp.
Very camp, yeah. Where Martyrs is very serious, and it's a very serious exploration of you know, capitalism and slavery and, you know, all of the, you know, these sorts of like, yeah, you know, destruction.
If that day comes, I want to be back. I want to like invoke my tenure and come back because I want to see Joe's face after he's seen Martyrs.
I'm just afraid it'll kill him.
It almost killed me. It was one of those films. I didn't know anything about it going into it. And I put it on. And it was like my mouth just kind of like kept opening more and more. And then like by the end of the film, it was just completely open. And I was just like, what the fuck did I just watch? And I literally just went up, pushed play again and watched the whole thing over. Cause I actually could not believe what I had just seen. I do love it. I think it's one of my favorites. It is not an easy watch.
No. Yeah.
Martyrs is one of three films at the very beginning of the podcast that Joshua was like, these are three films that I probably will not show you.
What are the other two?
The other two are Cannibal Holocaust and a Serbian film.
Okay. Please stay away from those.
And I'm like, okay, and then I just put it out of my mind as like, okay, well, these are, if Joshua is telling me that these are three films we will never, or at least definitely those two. Martyrs was kind of like mentioned in the same breath, but not necessarily with that like hard and fast thing on it. But like we did have our our inside irreversible, you know, our inside episode didn't was kind of like how can Joe handle French extremity?
And you did. No. You got through high tension. You got through inside l'intérieur.
Yeah, I was like,
I mean, it's a hard film. That's not an easy film.
No, not at all. But no. It was a great conversation.
It's a great Christmas film.
And again, time like abject horror, like, you know, that idea of like, Christmas, like this does not belong at Christmas time. It's lovely. Oh, okay. So we could talk. I mean, this is awesome. So we definitely want to have you back. You know, again, congrats on, you know, making it through school at all, you know, and, you know, getting to work on this excellent novel, you know, groundbreaking study of queer horror. I can't wait to see what you produce from that. And this was awesome talking about Dead Alive. Please, you know, we would love to have you back. And
I'd love to
talk about more movies and more things we can scare Joe with.
Never ever show him a Serbian film.
No, it's not necessary. There's lots to unpack, but. Think we can. Yes,
as far as horror goes, you can have an incredibly interesting conversation about it. I just never show it to Joe.
Yeah.
There's no need, Joe.
He deserves to keep some sweetness.
Your heart is too pure.
I don't know if I've ever told Joshua this, but maybe like a year into this, I did Wikipedia summary, like read the plot synopsis of a Serbian film, and that was enough.
That's all you need. That's
and
fine.
That was more than enough, actually, to... Yeah. You know,
we have some other hardcore horror fans that's the same. They're like, the Wikipedia was enough. Just the pictures it gave me, I didn't need to see it acted out, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyways, well, again, thank you so much, Heather. That was Dead Alive/Brain Dead, which I actually kind of like the Brain Dead title better because it just speaks even more to the stupidity of colonized thought.
Yeah, no, I think it's true.
But you know, either way, lots of fun. Definitely recommend people check it out, you know, and sure, watch this and then watch Lord of the Rings. do a compare contrast.
Well, watch this and watch Lord of the Rings Return of the King, which won the Oscar. Like watch
that
one and
the same person.
Are you either of you like the pinnacles where the Dead Alive opening is, it's like, is it called the Paths of the Dead? It's in Lord of the Rings, that exact same location.
I think it's in Return of the King. Yeah. I think that's where when Aragorn goes to like get the army of the dead, basically. Mm-hmm. Yes, I like Lord of the Rings.
Oh, my partner loves Lord of the Rings. In fact, the fact that I don't know exactly emphatically that it is Paths of the Dead, I'm probably gonna get some side look on that, but but you know, I do appreciate the Lord of the Rings trilogy for the time I saw them all in the theater. The Hobbit's kind of garbage, but Peter Jackson to me will always be Bad Taste through Heavenly Creatures.
I love that. That's awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for taking some time out of you know, your aggregating data or whatever. Writing
my pandemic life,
right? Yes. Existential you know, terror to chat about a movie that you clearly love very much, and we're so happy that you came and shared it with us. So look forward to chatting again sometime very soon. Stay safe and healthy, dear listener. Thank you as always for being here and giving us reason to keep talking. And Joe, I adore you. And I hope this film doesn't give you, well, no, I do actually hope it gives you some nightmares. But what else is new? But out of love.
So, I'm going to go eat some pudding right now.
There you go. I ate a big thing of meatballs and like marinara with mozzarella cheese afterwards. And I was just looking at it. Like, but I still ate it because that's, you know, me. All right. Good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davy Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
Ha 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 ha